wisdom. And yet something very interesting happened. So as I mentioned, I was working as a cook, and I noticed that when I would have a disagreement with a coworker in the kitchen over, say, how to cut the carrots or how long to steam the broccoli, all of the patience and compassion and kindness somehow seemed to just evaporate. Do you know this one? It was even more elusive with my family. You know, if I'd go down to Jersey for the weekend to see mom and dad or my brother, like, anytime things got difficult, the meditation practice, the awareness, the stability, the clarity, gone. And so I realized, okay, something's not working here. Right? The point of the practice isn't just to be able to sit still on our own when no one's bugging us and feel at peace, although I will say, like, that in and of itself is a pretty big accomplishment, the way our minds torment us. But to be able to bring it into our lives, right? To actually stay connected to awareness, to flexibility, to genuine care and compassion when things are hard. So if you look at the teachings of the Buddha, kind of the whole trajectory of the path is, one way we could put it, is about living a more meaningful life, really making the most of this opportunity that we have of being born and being human, discovering what it really means to be at peace. What does it mean to be at peace in a world that's constantly changing, that's not in our control, and that includes so much pain and suffering, and not just individually in our own lives, but on the planet, the level of suffering that exists and has existed. What does it mean to actually be at peace in this kind of a world? To have a lived understanding of that. That's the aim of this practice. And so if you look at the teachings, the Buddha begins with wisdom, starting to understand how we look at life and the kinds of intentions that will lead to more peace and understanding. In the Eightfold Path, those are the first two components, right view and right intention. But the very next thing he taught in the Eightfold Path, before meditation, before concentration, was right speech. Right after wisdom comes, pay attention to what you say. Pay attention to how you communicate. And I don't think this was an accident. The Buddha was very careful and deliberate in how he crafted his teachings. So as I started to notice this gap in the integration of my meditation practice in life, about that time, I came across the work of a man named Dr. Marshall Rosenberg, who founded a system of communication called nonviolent communication. He called it nonviolent communication for a few reasons. First and foremost, to place it within the tradition of Kingian and Gandhian nonviolence, because he saw a very powerful connection between our words, our language, the ways we think and relate to one another, and social change. That if we want to transform the institutions and the systems of our society, we need to learn how to speak and listen differently. It's very difficult to transform society without transforming our language. He also called it nonviolent communication because he found that there's a very direct link between how we think about things and the words that we use and our willingness to use violence to accomplish our aims in life. So I came across his work, and in this practice of communication, I found a bridge. I found something that helped me take the teachings of right speech, which are very beautiful and inspiring, and actually put them into practice in a more concrete way. And so for the last 15 or 20 years or so, I've been exploring this intersection between contemplative practice, the cultivation of mindfulness and compassion and wisdom internally, and our conversations and relationships externally. How do these two support and inform each other? One of the key insights that's at the heart of this work of what I call mindful communication, really bringing together the internal and the external, is how powerful communication is, not only in our lives, but also for transformation. Because we communicate all the time. If you think about it, we're communicating from the moment we wake up until the moment we go to bed. Most of us, most of the time. Even when we're alone, right? There's that inner monologue going. Or we're reading the news, or we're on social media, or we're texting or sending emails, or we're speaking with our family, with our friends, with coworkers, with doctors or people in our community. Communication is the stuff of our life, of our relationships. So if we're interested in transformation, if we're interested in understanding on a more deep level what it is to be human, communication is one of the most accessible and profound leverage points for change, precisely because we're doing it all the time. So if you make even one small change in your communication, it will have far-reaching impacts in every area of your life. It's unavoidable. I want to read to you just a few paragraphs from the introduction to my book, just to contextualize a little bit more broadly the role that communication plays in our lives as human beings. And then I want to share some practices with you, some principles and practices that you can take and start using. What we say matters. We've each felt the power that words have to heal, soothe, or uplift us. Even one caring remark can make the difference between giving up and finding the strength to face life's challenges. We each also know something of the great harm that can be inflicted through speech. Sharp words, laced with anger or cruelty, can break a relationship and burn for years. Language can be used to manipulate and coerce on a mass scale, to fuel fear, war, and oppression, even to advance political agendas of genocide or terror. Few things so powerful are also so commonplace. Words are woven into the fabric of our lives. Your first love, your first job, your last goodbye to someone you love. Our beginnings and endings and the countless moments in between are punctuated by a play of words as we share our thoughts, feelings, and desires. The creation myths of many cultures and religions through time, East, West, and Indigenous, recognize the generative power of words, giving the potency of speech a key role in the beginning of the cosmos. Indeed, words have the power to shape our reality. As we think, so we perceive. As we perceive, so we act. Moreover, the teachings of all world religions reflect a universal understanding about the ethical implications of language and its potential for good or harm, and include moral guidelines around the appropriate use of speech. What we say matters, perhaps now more than ever. We live in times of great change, in which much is being asked of us. We live at a time when we're less and less able to listen and really hear one another in society at a time when those with different views, beliefs, or backgrounds are once again so easily cast as the other. At this time when great forces of political, social, economic, and environmental change are sweeping the globe, intensifying our separation from self, others, and life, we need to learn how to speak and listen in a new way. So how do we do this? How do we take our contemplative practice and the values that animate it and bring it in to our conversations and relationships, even when things get tough? Hey, Corey, can you turn the pickup down just a little bit? There's kind of a little bit of an echo. So I want to share with you three core principles that are at the heart of this work and that kind of form the structure of the book. If you just turn it down a little bit, it'll probably either the gain or the volume. Okay, that's great, thanks. So the first foundation of bringing our contemplative practice into our conversations is presence. The ability to be here, to be aware, in a wholehearted and embodied way. The communication is fundamentally about understanding. Even if we're just trying to get something done, trying to accomplish a task, we still need to understand one another. So understanding is the currency of communication. If we're not here, if we're not present, good luck understanding anything. Have you ever had the experience of talking to someone and they're sitting like 4 feet away from you, but their mind is somewhere else? They're looking at the TV or they're daydreaming, and you say something, their ears are working perfectly, but it's like they don't even hear you. When there's no presence, no communication happens. Or you can be looking someone right in the eyes, right? Having a conversation, and it's like, hello, is anyone there? It's like they're not really connecting. You know that experience? And what about the inverse? How does it feel when someone really gives you their full attention? Right? That says something very powerful. It says, this conversation and you are important enough that I'm willing to give you one of my most precious resources. My time. My attention. My life energy. That sets the stage for a more effective conversation. For deepening a relationship. For working through something challenging. It starts to change the conditions between us when we give someone our full attention, when we really show up. So the first foundation of mindful communication is presence. And the instruction here, the practice here, is to learn how to lead with presence. To lead with presence means that before anything else, before what we want to say, before how we're feeling, before what happened, before any of that, can we just show up? Can we really be here in this moment with ourselves, with the other person? Now, this is no small feat. It's easy to be present when everything's going our way, of course. But when things get challenging or when we're under pressure, not so easy. And there are tremendous forces in our world today actively working against our ability to be present. Just the sheer level of information we are asked to process every day, or the amount of tasks and the number of demands placed on our time and energy in modern society, make it very challenging to stay present. I call it high-volume doing. We live in a society where we're asked to accomplish vast amounts of tasks, far more than our body or nervous system was really designed to do. Not only that, but the influence of technology and the media is continually fragmenting our attention. How quick and short all of the cuts are. If you watch television or commercials, how quickly things move on the internet, the instant kind of touch screen gratification of our society, all of that is going away from presence. So to lead with presence means countering the momentum of these forces in our society and actually reclaiming our attention. Saying that I'm going to determine where I place my attention rather than allowing external forces to decide that for me. This is huge. And this is one of the primary skills that we cultivate in contemplative practice, is the skill of attention, learning where and how and when to use our attention in a way that's for our welfare and for the welfare of others. So leading with presence rests on that ability to recognize when we're in a conversation with another person that we are in a conversation with another person. We can give them our full attention. We can actually show up. So some of you know I teach retreats, whole retreats on this, integrating mindfulness and meditation into relationship and conversation, looking at the intersection of these practices. Donald, who teaches here sometimes, and I teach these retreats together, as well as another colleague of mine from the East Coast. So Donald and I were teaching a retreat out in New Mexico a year or two ago. At the end of the retreat, we were having a closing circle where everyone was just sharing a few words about what they learned, what they were taking away. So the microphone comes around to this one gentleman, kind of a cowboy type from Colorado, maybe mid-70s. He'd been pretty quiet the whole week, so I was really curious, you know, what he had learned and what he was taking away. So the microphone comes around to him, and he takes this long pause. And he says, "What I realized this week is that my wife is the person I talk to the most, but talk with the least. I'm going to change that when I go home." So that's the power of leading with presence. We recognize that there's another human being in front of us. And that a conversation, even deeper, a relationship, is an experience of mutuality. Without presence, there's no mutuality. And without mutuality, there's no real conversation or relationship. So this is the first foundation. And I want to give you one or two tools, one or two practices that you can start using right now, even as you sit here listening. So the first is, right now, are you aware of your body? Maybe now you are. Okay. So as you listen, see if you can keep just a little bit of attention in your body, feeling your hands or the contact with the chair. It's not that hard, is it? But see if you can maintain it. So our mind moves a million miles an hour. It goes into the past, into the future. We can be halfway around the world in a nanosecond. The body always stays right here. It doesn't go into the past or the future, at least not yet. So if you are aware of a sensation in your body, you are, for that moment, present. So if you can keep a little bit of attention in your body in a conversation, that's helping you to stay aware, to ground, to stay present. This is one way to learn how to lead with presence more in your life. The Buddha called this the first foundation of mindfulness, being aware of the body. Another very powerful way to practice leading with presence in your conversations and your relationships is a very, very simple tool, which is to pause. It doesn't need to be a long pause. It could just be half a breath, a second or two. But that little bit of time gives us enough space to choose how we relate, how we engage. Another very important part of leading with presence is that one of the benefits it gives us is that it allows us to make choices. The more aware we are, the more choice we have. And when we pause, we give ourselves that time to make a different choice, to consider, is this going to be helpful to say? Or if we're looking at writing and electronic communication, pausing before you hit send on that email or that text message, right? I'm sure we all have had that experience of sending a message when we're upset, only to regret it later and wish we could take it back, right? They actually have email programs now that some programs will, like when you hit send, it waits for like a minute before you send it so that if you change your mind, you can still undo. So the pause gives us that space to reflect and consider, do we want to actually proceed? Is this wise? Is this helpful? So one of the little postcards here on the table, you can take a few of these if you want, says pause. One breath can change what you say next. So you could put this by your computer, on your refrigerator. Very, very helpful tool to lead with presence. So this is the first part. So presence gets us on the map. It actually like gets us onto the playing field of having a more effective and meaningful conversation. The next foundation is about our intention, where we're coming from. Our intention is the motivation or the quality of heart behind our words, actions, or choices. So where are we coming from in a conversation? What's our intention? What's our motivation? Are we even aware of it? Have we paid enough attention to recognize the results of different intentions, right? How well does it work when we're just trying to manipulate things and get our way? Maybe we can get some results, but it comes at a cost, right? There's a bill to pay later when we force people to do things they don't want to do. When we get someone to agree to something because we're pressuring them or blaming them or using guilt or shame. What's the effect when we're trying to hog the limelight or prove a point and be right and just steamroll someone? It feels good maybe in the moment if we win, but what's the effect later? So we start to study and see how different intentions have different results in our life and in our relationships. This is cultivating wisdom. So there's certain intentions that are reliably helpful in conversation. One of the most powerful intentions that we can cultivate in a conversation is the genuine intention to understand. Precisely because communication is about understanding one another. Again, even if we're trying to get something done, we need some level of understanding. So as a default, we can cultivate an intention to understand. It's not the only useful intention, but it's a good fallback. So I don't know if you've noticed, I haven't said anything yet about what we say. I said there are three parts to this model. We've talked about presence, we're talking about intention now. Both of those are internal experiences, right? Because communication is fundamentally not about what we say. It's about where we're coming from and the level of understanding or connection that we're able to create with someone. So if you're having a conversation with someone and they're saying one thing with their words, but their tone of voice, their posture, their facial expressions or their gestures are saying something else, which do you believe? Right? We believe the body language. That's why it's not about what we say. It's about where we're coming from. We are highly sensitive, empathic creatures. We pick up on so much, even below the surface of our awareness. If you're not coming from a clear and helpful intention, on some level, the other person is going to sense that, and it's going to pit you against each other. So having a helpful, positive intention in a relationship that's clear, that's conscious, that again is starting to create the conditions for hearing one another, working together, understanding each other. It's our intention that shapes so much of that non-verbal communication, the tone, the gesture, the body language. All of that is, to a large degree, a reflection and a manifestation of our deeper intention. So choosing our intention in a conversation will start to shape all of that nonverbal communication and will subtly begin to direct the conversation in a certain way. So the instruction here, the practice here, is to come from curiosity and care. This is the second foundation of intention. Can we learn, can we train ourselves to come from curiosity and care? These are two of the most powerful intentions in our meditation practice. Mindfulness and kindness. Mindfulness is the intention to understand rather than to judge, to look closely at our experience and want to know it clearly. Loving kindness, metta, is that caring, that kindness, that warmth that allows us to actually look deeply and be in contact with difficult things. So we bring those same intentions from our contemplative practice into a relationship, into the conversation, coming from curiosity and care. I want to be clear, care doesn't mean that we care, care doesn't mean that everyone's our best friend. It doesn't mean that we like everyone. Let's be real, we don't. We have our preferences. Some people we like, we get along really well with. Others we don't get along so well with. That's fine. It means that we don't harbor ill will or enmity, which damages our own well-being as well as our relationships. It means that we stay connected to the quality of care, caring about each other's humanity, and on a deeper level, caring about our own values, that we're connected to what we care about, our sense of integrity and dignity, how we want to walk in this world, the kinds of relationships and conversations we want to create. So coming from curiosity and care means that we are conscious in the flow of the exchange about how we want to engage. Not just what I want to say or what I hoped will happen, but how do I want to live? Am I walking my talk? So there are many ways to practice this, to cultivate these qualities of curiosity and care, these deep intentions in our conversations. I want to give you just one tool that you can play with, you can experiment with. And this is the possibility of listening in a certain way. Listening is a very powerful way to cultivate curiosity and care. And it's often one of the places that conversations break down, is that both people lose the ability to listen. If neither of us can listen, we're no longer having a conversation. That's the time to stop, to take a break. There's no communication happening. It's like being on a cell phone call and the line dropped. The call's no longer connected. We're both still talking, but the call dropped a long time ago. So when we listen, listening itself is a practice of cultivating curiosity and care. What's it like to really listen? To not be waiting for your turn, building an argument, thinking about something else, wondering when they're going to shut up. To actually listen. It's an incredible relief, actually. It doesn't take that much energy. To not have to come up with something, to not have to fix someone else's problems or make them better, figure it all out, to just listen and try to hear what they're saying. I said I was going to give you one tool, I'm going to give you two. So just listening is one. So then another is, as you listen, you can remind yourself of this intention to come from curiosity and care by doing something very simple and subtle. So before you respond, before you say whatever it is you want to say, whatever it is you want to add to the argument, I invite you to say something to the effect of, let me see if I'm getting it. Let me see if I'm with you. Let me see if I'm following. And then tell the person what you're hearing. Just a short phrase like that, it reminds us to really pay attention, to be curious, to care about the conversation. And it signals to the other person that we're actually trying to understand them, which has an effect. It builds trust. It aligns us with one another. And it helps to clarify what matters in the conversation. So find your own words for that. Let me see if I'm hearing you. Let me see if I've got it. Let me see if I'm on the same page. Here's what I'm getting. Tell them back what you're hearing. Try it out. Now, obviously, we don't do this all the time. If someone says, can you pass the salt? We don't say, let me see if I'm with you. You want me to pass you the salt, right? It's idiotic, right? We use this tool when it's necessary, right? If things are complicated, if they're intense, if there's a lot of emotion, if we're having trouble following. So use your wisdom, use your judgment about when you use this. So lead with presence. You can feel your body, you can pause. Come from curiosity and care. Really listen. Offer back what you're hearing. Check if you're understanding the person. I'll tell you a very short short version of a story that I tell in the book. I go into more detail in the book about the power of coming from curiosity and care, the power of our intention in a relationship or a conversation. There's an African-American musician by the name of Darryl Davis, lives on the East Coast. One of his passions in life is understanding racism. He experienced some very challenging aggression towards him as a young African-American boy growing up in sort of white part of Boston, Massachusetts. And it left him with this very burning question of, how can someone hate me if they don't know me? How can they hate me if they don't know me? And so while he says, my profession was music, my obsession became understanding hatred and racism. So he was playing a gig down in Southern Maryland with this jazz band. And on the set break, this white guy comes up to him, strikes up a conversation and says, you play the piano pretty well for an African American. He's kind of like puzzled, because that's sort of a funny thing to say, you know. The gentleman says, you almost play as well as Jerry Lee Lewis. So for those of you who don't know jazz music, Jerry Lee Lewis is a white piano player. So Darryl Davis kind of says, Jerry Lee Lewis learned how to play from African American boogie-woogie and blues musicians. This gentleman says, that's not true. He says, actually, it is true. I know Jerry Lee. He's a friend of mine. And he says, oh, wow, really? You know Jerry? So they sit down. He invites him to sit down and have a drink. Anyway, make a long story short, this gentleman, over the course of the conversation, Darryl just being very curious and asking questions, turns out this guy's a member of the local Ku Klux Klan. But they get to know each other, and they exchange information, and Darryl stays in touch, and they have conversations. So Darryl decides he wants to learn more about not only this gentleman, but other people in his community, and what makes them choose to join this organization. He decides he wants to write a book about the KKK. And through this one connection, ends up setting up interviews with many members of the organization. So through the course of his relationships and conversations with these men down in Southern Maryland, he actually befriends the grand wizard of the whole organization. All through the power of kindness, respect, interest, asking questions and really listening and wanting to understand. And, disagreeing, engaging in debate, but with respect, with interest, with curiosity and care. Through the power of dialogue alone, between 40 and 50 members of the KKK, directly through their conversations with Darryl, left the organization. Several of them gave him their robes and hood. The Grand Wizard asked Daryl to be his daughter's godfather. This is the power of intention. The whole organization collapsed. More than 200 people left the organization because of the conversations he had and the relationships he established. Now, not every single person came around. There were people who didn't. But the vast majority were deeply affected by their relationship with him. And the power of his intention to really understand. There are other dimensions to this story, of course. It's complicated. He was a black man doing work that, in many respects, is the work of white people to educate other white people about racism. And yet, this example just really shows how far our intention can go in a conversation. So the last foundation, the last step in this process is about where we place our attention. I talked about this in the beginning, and leading with presence, really showing up. In the conversation, what are we focusing on? Are we fixated on our judgments, on the narrative of blame that we're telling, on the outcome, the one thing that we want to happen, and we have to have it that way or else? Or are we paying attention to things that will actually help us hear one another? So this last training of our attention is about learning to focus on what matters. What's most important? Are we even aware of what matters to us in the conversation? And this is where the training of nonviolent communication really comes in. The training of nonviolent communication teaches us to notice and be aware of four different things in any conversation, relationship, or experience. It teaches us to notice what happened, the specific observations in a situation, distinct from our judgments and interpretations and evaluations. This in and of itself is a very powerful training. It's part of the training of meditation to separate the direct experience of what's happening from the stories that we tell about it. So much of the time in our conflicts and conversations, it's the stories that we're telling ourselves that get in the way of really hearing one another. So starting to distinguish those stories from the actual data. What happened? Next, how do we feel? How do we feel about what happened? What are the actual emotions that are running through us? If we're not aware of our emotions, they're going to be pushing us around in the conversation. So learning to be aware of our emotions and to relate to them with balance and poise and choice. And then next, and perhaps most importantly, why? Why do we feel that way? We only feel emotions about things that we care about. If we didn't care about it, we wouldn't be feeling anything about it. So our feelings are information that point back to something more fundamental, our deeper values or needs, what really matters to us in a situation. Identifying this is transformative. When we can identify what actually matters in a situation to ourselves as well as to someone else, it gives us more room to hear and understand one another, to be creative, to step outside of the specific strategies and outcomes that we're fixated on and be more creative, to have new solutions and ideas, because we're no longer thinking only in one way, this is what has to happen. But we start to recognize, oh, well, this is what this is about. Fundamentally, this is what matters. When we identify that, there are more options and choices. So I want to just give you one brief example of the power of the difference between what we want, a specific solution or strategy, and why we want it. The underlying need, what matters in a situation. So one person went to a nonviolent communication workshop and heard this distinction between what we want and why we want it, between our strategies, the things that we do in life, and why they actually matter. And on his way home, he reached for a cigarette. He was a smoker. And as he reached for the cigarette, he remembered that perspective from the workshop, that our behavior as human beings is trying to meet some deeper underlying need. There's something that matters. So he considered, he said, well, if that's true, what matters to me here? Why do I want to smoke a cigarette? So what do you think he realized? What do you think he might have been after in smoking the cigarette?
Tension.
Relieving tension. What else?
Connection.
Connection with himself, maybe. What else? So avoiding feelings, so maybe a sense of relief, wanting some relief, some relaxation. So, you know, he contemplated and he realized, yeah, you know, I want to take a break, I want to relax, I want to take my mind off things. And in that moment he realized, geez, I got far better ways of relaxing and taking my mind off things than poisoning my health. He stopped smoking. If we're unaware of what matters to us, if we're not aware of the needs that we're trying to meet in our life, we are bound to continue repeating the same behaviors over and over again without actually knowing why we're even doing them. So this is on a personal level. Focusing on what matters gives us more choice and flexibility. In relationship, it opens the door to our shared humanity. We don't have to agree with someone, but can we see what matters to them underneath their views and their opinions and their actions that we may very strongly disagree with? So nonviolent communication teaches us to focus on what happened, how we feel about it, why, what matters, and where do we want to go from here? What kinds of requests can we make to move a conversation forward one step at a time? This is training our attention. So one of the other postcards that's out there says, focus on what matters, the rest is extra. Don't get caught up in the details. So if we can take these three principles of leading with presence, coming from curiosity and care, and focusing on what matters, and apply them in our life, in our conversations, in our relationships, if you take even one of them and apply it consistently, you will see changes in your life. Communication is really complex. There's a lot going on. It doesn't change overnight. But if you make one small change, it's like changing the angle of the rudder on a ship. At first, it doesn't seem like much difference. But over time, that ship ends up going in a very different direction just by changing the angle 1 or 2 degrees. So I invite you to think about one thing that you've heard tonight that makes sense to you. One tool that you want to practice with, pausing, feeling your body, really listening, asking someone, let me see if I'm hearing you right, or focusing on what matters. Try to discern what's most important to me, what matters to you in this situation. And remember it, come back to it again and again, practice with it. I guarantee you, you will see changes. Thank you so much for your kind attention. We have a few minutes if there are any questions that you'd like to ask about anything that I've shared or your practice. You can raise your hand and one of our generous Marin Sangha folks will bring over the mic. Thanks, Corey.
It's always amazing when you have an experience and then it comes up again on the same day. But a friend of mine called me this morning and told me she'd taken a workshop in listening.
Yeah.
And I'm having this conversation with her and I'm realizing that my response to her talking, I'm starting to get self-conscious about it. Because it's either I'm acknowledging or I'm comparing or I'm waiting to talk or, you know, all those things. So I guess my question is, how do you let someone know that you're listening? Because I think I've been trained to say something to let them know I'm listening versus, or is it just as well to be quiet, you know, just maybe you could just talk about that.
Thank you, sure. I think a lot of that signaling happens non-verbally, right? Like as I was listening to you without thinking about it, I was kind of nodding, I was making eye contact. There's that kind of subvocal, like, right? And so that signals, that nonverbal communication and the body language signals to the other person, like, I'm with you, I'm here, I'm listening. Oh, yeah, I get it. Yeah, yeah, uh-huh. So a lot of it comes through that. I think a lot depends on the context also and the person. Like for some people, some of it's cultural as well. For some people, being quiet, or in some cultures, being quiet and listening silently is very respectful. In other cultures, if you don't say anything, it's rude. You know, the way to show that you're engaged in listening is to interrupt the other person. So I think it really depends on the context. What I would be interested also for you to explore is to look a little bit more closely at whatever the discomfort or the anxiety that you're feeling is, and where's that coming from? Right? Is there anything in you that's actually getting in the way of being natural in the conversation? That you're wanting to let the other person know you're listening, or you're wanting to be accepted, or just to get curious about that and see. Because basically any mental activity or strong emotion will interfere with our experience of listening. Listening is a very deep kind of silence and quiet in the mind. It's one of the metaphors we use for meditation, is a very deep listening. There's a stillness in it. So see what's getting in the way of that kind of quiet and listening, and how that can relax. Thank you. Please.
So thank you for that. I had the very good fortune to actually study NBC on and off for about 10 years.
Great.
It's been a while.
Yeah.
And I probably don't practice it as well as I might.
Uh-huh.
And I just want to give a shout out for it, because it totally saved various relationships in my life.
That's wonderful. Yeah.
And especially asking the question, are you feeling, and then guessing, and then I could be wrong, and then the person gets to. So it's been a real good tool in my tool bag. And I really enjoyed listening tonight to your Dharma embodiment of it. Mm-hmm. Thinking of it as, I mean, I realized looking back we were doing this, but I didn't put it in the languaging of cultivating attention, or cultivate the typical Dharma languaging.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a really nice blending, and I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Yeah, I really can't recommend this training enough. It's certainly transformed my life and my relationships, you know, with family, with friends, and also has developed a lot more confidence in being able to handle things relationally. You know, someone gets mad at you, you screw up, it's like, okay, no big deal. You know, we can handle this. Right? We often feel so anxious when there's any conflict or difference, because we don't have the skills to navigate it, and we're afraid of things going wrong, of hurting each other more, of the relationship ending or blowing up, just because we lack the skill. And the great kind of gift here is that these are not just like innate talents, that some people are born being good communicators and others aren't. These are learnable skills. And we can actually change and transform our communication so that we can have better relationships in our lives.
Again, thank you. I'll just add that it, along with topic of shame and Dharma practice, which I did a lot of work on with the previous teacher, this practice of NBC, those four questions,
mm-hmm.
the observation, feelings, needs, strategy.
Requests, uh-huh.
Yeah. It gave me confidence to have less shame if
mm-hmm.
I did screw up.
Mm-hmm.
Not
yeah.
that I never get nervous or scared about
yeah.
it, but
yeah.
to have the self-compassion.
Yeah, it's a very powerful tool to transform our judgments, the judgments that we make of ourselves, of others, that lead to that experience of shame or anger, and to see that those judgments are information, and that they point to our own needs and values. And when we can understand the underlying needs and values beneath the judgment, we don't need to actually hold on to or believe the judgment anymore, because we've gotten to the essence of it.